This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you were searching for a life on another planet, what would you look for? Where would you look for it? Well, at the top of the list, of course, things you'd be looking for would be water. Life here on Earth isn't possible without it, so we'd look for water, right? Well, number two on the list would be some source of energy for the planet. You know, here on Earth, that would be the sun. On our planet, sunlight is necessary for photosynthesis. Scientists looking for life on Mars have been following this plan. They're looking for water, scouring the planet with orbiting satellites high above the surface, and roving laboratories on the planet, photographing and sampling the red planet soil. And so far, they've found lots of evidence that in its early days, Mars was a water-rich planet, and hints that the water that formed many of its surface features may still be there somewhere below the surface. The latest evidence comes today in the journal Science. Detailed photos from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter suggest that water once flowed through the bedrock in a canyon. Now that scientists have made their case for water on Mars, the next step to follow is the energy route to figure out how the planet could provide fuel for living things. And chances are pretty good that a living thing on Mars would use a different form of energy than most living things on Earth. While much of life here, as I say, depends on photosynthesis, there are living things on this planet that do not. They get their energy living in dark, deep rocks well below the surface or at the bottom of the ocean where no light can penetrate. And studying this, these extremophiles give scientists clues to what they might be looking for on Mars, perhaps the same kind of tough life living below the surface. It doesn't depend on light for its energy. So this hour, we're going to be talking about the search for life on Mars, just what scientists are looking for as we broadcast from the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science here in San Francisco. So if you'd like to join our discussion, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And if you're here in our audience, please remember there's a microphone in the middle of the room there. Don't be afraid to get up and ask a question. We welcome you. And we also welcome 11th and 12th graders from Lowell High School here in San Francisco who are eager to participate, I can see from their bright faces in Science Friday. We'll see what kind of questions they may have. Let me introduce my guests. David DeMaray is the long-term planning lead for the Mars Exploration Rover mission and senior research scientist in the astrobiology program at the NASA Ames Research Center in Moffett Field, California, just down the road a piece, as we say here. Welcome to the program, Dr. DeMaray. Michael Carr is planetary geologist at the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, California. Welcome back, Dr. Carr.
Thank you.
And Tori Holler is a research scientist in the astrobiology department at NASA Ames, also at Moffett Field. Welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Dr. Holler. Who wants to answer? If I say, where are we? How is the search going? What would you say?
Want to start with water?
Michael, you want to begin?
Okay, I'll start with the broad outline of the water story. Mm-hmm. When you think about Mars, you've got to think about it in two pieces. One is a very ancient Mars, and then the rest of the story. We can recognize very ancient terrains on Mars, and they are all, nearly all, very highly dissected by dry river valleys. And we've tried to figure out ways that these could form other than by erosion of water. And really, there is no other way. This is very compelling that at this early period, this very early period, there was the conditions were such that water, you could have rainfall or snowfall, and you could get liquid water running across the surface. And in recent years, we've gotten supporting evidence for that model. We now see lots of areas where there were lakes. We know there are lakes because you can see deltas where these dry river valleys run into these lakes. And the problem we're having with this very compelling geologic story is we don't know how Mars could have been warmed up very early in its history. And yet it's really, really compelling.
So where is all that water that used to be there?
Well,
is it still there?
Well, I probably is. Most of it probably is. But let me just touch on the rest of the story.
That's a good part of it.
Yeah. So after this early era, the kind of water-worn feature that one sees are very different. The kinds are very different. What we see in this younger era of huge, huge floods, and they look as though water basically just burst out of the ground. And probably in order for these large floods to form, it probably had to be cold. So the ground was probably frozen very deeply. And the probably liquid water is either below that frozen ground, mm-hmm. and sometimes it's under pressure and it bursts out, or it's as ice in the shallower depths. So it probably most of the water is there now, but in the ground.
So if you want to find it, you have to go deep.
Want to find liquid water, you've either got to go deep or you've got to go to a volcano. And there's strong evidence that Mars is presently volcanically active. And so one would expect the ground to be warm and the liquid water then might be present in such areas.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, and this, of course, is off to a great start. I should say also that in the area of remote sensing with satellites, we're now moving into an era where we not only can look at the ground and look at these wonderful features that Mike has mentioned, but we can begin to ask questions about their composition. What are they made of? And another important dimension of water is what it does to things chemically, mm-hmm. alteration, and, of course, it supports life. And we're now entering an era with some of these exciting new missions where we can do that. The bottom line is you got to get your boots on the ground, though. How do we go down to the ground? Because if you're really going to be in the life detection business, you have to get close to the samples. And the Mars Exploration Rover, I think, has illustrated graphically, the challenge that we face when you're looking at a planet whose surface, to a first order, has been very dry and cold for a long time. And that is much of what has altered the surface at the scale that you're at when you're there with the rover is volcanism, impacts, and just wind-blown processes. Mm-hmm. And none of this stuff sounds very exciting for habitable environments. So we have to sort of get past those things and look at these earlier history and maybe evidence of the deep subsurface that Mike alluded to. And the two rovers are a classic demonstration of what we sort of encountered. With Gusev crater, with the Spirit rover, we said, here's a nice crater with a big channel that obviously brought a lot of water into it. Wow, let's go there. Let's literally follow that channel's water to Gusev crater. With Opportunity, we said, here is a mineral at the surface. And we think when we see this coarse-grained mineral on Earth, hematite, that was formed by water. Let's go there because that may be a beacon telling us that water was there. Opportunity, boom, right off the top, finds itself surrounded with outcrops and materials that really allowed it to make pretty substantially rapid progress on answering the question of was water there. Spirit, we had to wander for like 2 or 3 months to get away from that stuff that is sitting on that what must have been a lake bed, but it's volcanic rock. And if you're a rover trying to analyze things, you know, that's a step away from where you want to be. So the landscape is wonderful because it sort of indicates where there might have been water, but the minerals, the composition is what really tells you where the evidence mm-hmm. lies. So we need to look at where water has really done something to rocks and created a record to make that big next step.
And we haven't gotten there yet.
Well, we haven't detected evidence of life. Yeah. We would argue that in the case of Meridiani, we've detected evidence of environments that might have been habitable at some time in the past, and I would argue that even at Gusev Crater, we've now found evidence that's consistent with habitable environments in the subsurface, perhaps, sometime in the past.
And we keep seeing, from the reconnaissance satellites also, the reconnaissance satellite, evidence of, there was that wonderful sort of a burp, it looked like water came out of the side of a gully. There was the white residue left, right?
That's right. Yeah.
And how old could that have been?
Well, of course, the exciting observation there was that a feature that was not there in, 1997 was seen in 2004. So some of these white-like streaks that came down the slopes are literally, less than, 8 years old or so.
And that's what makes you think there's water somewhere below the surface still popping out every once in a while.
Well, no good scientific observation would be complete without a good scientific debate, okay? And Mike can perhaps give you a little more of a capsule summary about the nature of that debate.
Yeah, these gullies are really quite controversial. They're just a few meters across, and they run down at the run down steep slopes. And one problem with the supposition that they're formed by groundwater is that they are located, or they seem to start in places where you wouldn't expect to see groundwater, like at the top of a crater rim, right, right. At the top of the rim, or at the top of a central peak in a crater. And they don't all start at a stratum in the crater. And so other suggestions have been made, such as destabilization of slopes by volatiles such as water ice or carbon dioxide ice evaporating when the sun hits it, or earthquake shaking, mm-hmm. or just dry rivulets like sand. You know, there's a lot of different ways that one might explain these gullies. The problem with the idea that water is just sitting behind that slope waiting to squirt out is it's absolutely incompatible with what we know about the conditions. And so there's great reluctance to... It's much too cold. The surface is minus average daily temperature at the surface where these things are found are about minus 65 to minus 75 degrees centigrade. It's very, very cold. And the heat flow on Mars is low, and so you wouldn't expect that at these shallow depths that the temperatures would be anywhere near 0 degrees centigrade. They're much lower than that. Mm-hmm. So
it's a problem. It's a problem that you don't accept that explanation. You're
getting the sense that I don't?
I'm sort of picking that up, you know? This is that.
Well, let me just add one other explanation which has been proposed.
Well, I'm going to have you hold that explanation.
Okay.
Because as they say in some of these TV shows, we have to go to a break. So stay with us. We'll come back and talk more and hear the other explanation, talk with Michael Carr, and get your questions from the audience, from the phones, 1-800-989-8255, talking about the searching for life, water, energy on Mars, and possibly finding it someday. So stay with us. We'll be right back after the short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the search for life on Mars. We're here in San Francisco at the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Last up was Michael Carr, talking with him about these pictures we've seen that a lot of people have accepted as being true, that there is water squirting out of the sides of these gullies on Mars, and there's white residue left over from when it ablates. Wouldn't evaporate, it would ablate. And then leaving the residue behind, and you're giving us the other side, the skeptics debate side. Tell us. What else could it have been?
Yeah, I was going to mention one other possibility, and Dave has yet another, and that is that Mars has a very strange orbital it goes through orbital perturbations, and what happens periodically is that the rotation axis sort of tilts more toward the sun, and when that happens, ice gets evaporated from the poles and it lands at the equator. And some people have suggested that the melting of ice could make these gullies during these periods when the tilt of the axis is more toward the sun.
Mm-hmm. Let me before I get back to Dave, I want to ask to bring Tori in. Tori Hola, you're looking for the energy side.
Yeah.
How do you find the energy that might power life?
Yeah, well, the important consideration on Mars is that, water is sort of a binary indicator for life. Mm-hmm. It tells us either this is a good place to look for life because water has been around, or it's not a good place to look for life because water has never been here. Mm-hmm. But we know from our own experience that's not enough. People here in the live audience could probably tell you that life needs both water and food. And so we're asking, really, what do you gain by asking and following the food on Mars? And by food, what I mean is energy, the energy that we require to keep ourselves going, to grow, and just to live.
Mm-hmm. Is there life on Earth that we've found? You know, it's almost, some of it is so strong living in those hot, water vents at the bottom of the oceans and other places where it's It seems to be pretty tough. Is there any candidates that could live on Mars and under some conditions there?
We think there are. And one of the problems in trying to look at Earth analogs to look for this sort of life is it's actually really hard to find a place where our surface biosphere, the biosphere that's dominated by photosynthesis, mm-hmm. has not pervaded into the subsurface. The products of photosynthesis, if you're not looking at light itself as an energy source, but rather the products of photosynthesis, the organic matter, the oxygen, and so forth, it's actually hard to get away from that stuff. But we have in a few cases now, and we feel like there are a couple of candidate places that could support the sort of life that we might have on Mars. So, for example, there have been studies in some deep mines that look at ultimately radioactivity as an energy source. So it turns out that radioactivity can split water in a way that transmits energy into a useful form into bacteria. Mm-hmm. There's apparently a biosphere that's running on that. Certain sorts of rocks that can react with water that lead to supportive life. So there are beginning to be a couple of places now just starting to be understood that we think could be candidates for a deep life on Mars.
Would you look for those places on Mars too? I mean, the water guys are going to say, well, you got to don't go anywhere where there's no water. I'll assume. Well, you're going to say, well, we have to find a place where there might be some energy source.
Well, I think there's an interesting issue on Mars, which is you have a couple of choices in front of you, and really what you have to do is prioritize what you'd like to look for. Mm-hmm. So if you follow the water on Mars, historically, you're following a trajectory from a planet dominated by surface water in its early history where life would have been available as an energy source. And we know from our own planet that's a great source of energy, mm-hmm. leads to lots and lots of life and lots of evidence that we could potentially discover. If we ask about life on Mars now, right. we've had to follow water under the surface. And so now we really are talking about needing to look at the rocks themselves as potential sources of energy. Mm-hmm. So what you're left to do is to try to prioritize, would I rather look for 4-billion-year-old evidence of potentially abundant life or much more modern evidence of potentially much less abundant and much more cryptic life?
Can you look for both?
I think you'd have to pick and choose your spots carefully. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are questions of access as well. In order to look for subsurface life, what would you need to do? You'd either need to find a way to drill into the subsurface.
Right.
And potentially, we're talking about a long, long way. As Mike described, prospective aquifers on Mars are really quite deep. That's logistically a very difficult thing to do, even here. On Mars, it would be a real challenge. What could you rely on instead? Well, maybe these catastrophic outflow channels, if that is in fact one of the explanations for them, that would be a very intriguing place to look, because there you'd had a place where subsurface water had been brought to the surface. But as Mike and Dave just described, it's very much in question whether that's what really those represent.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do then? And what do you know, if you're sitting there and you're Michael, Dave, you're now working for NASA, trying to pick the next site, the spot, what do you look for? What's your ideal place? If I gave you a blank check, what would you build the kind of craft and what would it do?
Well, I tell you, the first thing we'd do is give ourselves a year or two to take advantage of these wonderful new images coming down from high-rise, from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter with the high-rise camera, 30-centimeter ground resolution, and also an instrument called CRISM, which is a near-infrared spectrometer that is going to do a pretty darn good job on mineralogy at a ground scale of about 15 meters. Give them a chance to look this place over and mm-hmm. look for the kinds of rock types, as Tori mentioned, that might be really good places to act as energy sources for life. The subsurface isn't as hopeless as trying to put a drill down there. Meteorite impacts have done a good job of excavating things for us. In fact, the science paper we just talked about looked in the wall of a canyon and found a fracture that was filled with a deposit that was put there in the subsurface, but here it is now on the surface. Now, getting there with a rover might be a challenge, but this is an example of how the impacts and the erosion that's occurred on Mars is laying bare evidence that was once far below the surface. So there's an approach there. As far as the active water today, we also doing radar experiments where we're looking for where there might be liquid water in the subsurface using radar. You don't have to go there physically. Mm-hmm. You go there with your geophysics. And then, of course, in the ancient record, again, using these same wonderful orbiters, you look for environments where the rock has been maybe altered by water, and there are types of deposits that might preserve evidence of fossils within them.
Is that an easier bet to find past life than to find something that might be living now?
Well, absolutely yes. And the reason I say that is that geologic deposits can integrate evidence over a long period of time. So you're benefiting from things that have happened, you know, for hundreds of millions of years, as opposed to something that just happened last week. Even if life is there today, you may find it by finding a fossil of something equivalent to it that got thrown to the surface a million years ago. And that's still looking for evidence of past life, but very relevant to present life on Mars.
I remember the old Viking lander in the 70s, when it got there, tried to make a little experiment of sprinkling stuff on the surface and seeing if there was, you know, evidence that there might be something living that would transform it into something detectable. Can you redo that? Is that a smart experiment to redo, or was that just something let's give it a shot, maybe it'll work? And redo it differently today than you would have?
Well, the quick answer to that is that you have to have the right sample to put into that little experiment.
Right.
The second answer, which has come by research on microbiology, is that there are a lot of organisms on the Earth that wouldn't respond to that cocktail if you gave it to them. One of the sort of consequences of discovering that there's all these different lifestyles of the type that Tori referred to is that some of them just would turn up their noses at what we served up in the Viking dinner plate. And so we have to be a little more sophisticated on how we would do that type of experiment.
So we wouldn't do that?
We wouldn't do Viking again.
No, but something like that would create another experiment.
This is an area of active discussion right now within NASA. You know, what would be a serious, meaningful, broad-based life detection experiment that you could do remotely? Most people would argue, got to bring that sample back to do the real life detection experiment, and you cannot argue with the power we would have in terrestrial laboratories, you know, laboratories on the Earth, to do those types of experiments.
Well, there was once a mission called the Sample Return Mission.
That's right.
Is that still around?
It's like a mirage. It's over the financial horizon.
It's always in someone else's budget, right? Not in your budget. So was that access part of the cutback in NASA's plans to go to the moon and to Mars?
I think sample return was we already sort of had planned it into the late 2010 sort of decade, even before the outset of the lunar. Yeah.
Okay, let me go to the audience here. Yes, sir, step up to the mic.
Hello, I'm George from Lowell High School. And I was wondering, because the atmospheric pressure on Mars is less than 1% of what it is on Earth, from what I understand, there wouldn't be any liquid water on the surface. And all the water that would be underground wouldn't be able to be heated like it is on Earth, because Mars is so much smaller and the core is so much more cooled down. So how does that go in face of finding life there and so on?
Do you want to address
Michael?
Yes, you're right. It's very difficult to get liquid water on Mars today. There are two things that are working against it. One is temperature. And I'd mentioned the minus 65 degrees centigrade average, you know, daily average temperature. And also the atmosphere is very thin. And in fact, the average pressure is below what is called a triple point of water, where liquid water can exist. And so for average Mars, you simply cannot have liquid water. However, there are places where liquid water could exist for very short periods of time. For example, if you had some ice on the surface and the sun hit it and you were at a very low area, so the pressure was above this triple point, you could have liquid water form temporarily, but it's so cold that it would soon freeze. And that's a big, big issue, because how do you then explain all these features that we see that are formed by water? And that's the probably the most glaring problem that we have, climatic problem that we have.
Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
I'd like to answer your question specifically, though, about the subsurface. And yes, Mars is probably cooler on the inside, but it's a very important point he made earlier. There's still active volcanic activity on Mars. There are places in the subsurface where it's pretty darn hot. And somewhere between that cold surface and that really hot subsurface is, you know, it's the Goldilocks and the Three Bears thing, you know, it's just right.
I mean, well, you have found that this research, the latest evidence, it's the science paper today shows that there were canyons full of water down there. I mean, you know, here you have canyons full of water, there's algae or something growing in it, you know, even in the dark. Could that be possible on Mars also?
Well, in the distant past, that's the key.
The evidence for the canyons being full of water is really pretty good. And these are huge canyons.
And these were how long ago? Or are they still filled now?
Billions of years ago. Right.
Right.
What you see inside these canyons are layered stacks of layered sediments, and they have lots of sulfate in them.
Right.
So they're probably water deposited in some way. And then you see out of the one end of them the huge channels. So as though there was a dam, and the dam broke, and all the water drained out of the canyons. Yeah, and so
some mysterious event happened on Mars that drained all this water, this warm environment that they had, and now suddenly it became a cold place and froze everything.
Well, the conditions could have been cold when there was water in the canyon.
Mm-hmm. But not as cold as today.
Probably.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm Rebecca, a senior at Lowell High School here in San Francisco, and my question is, are there a lot of volcanic explosions on Mars as a result of the underground water pressure? And if so, does this affect the environment of Mars?
There were in War of the Worlds, there were a lot of volcanic explosions.
Yeah, that's a very good question. It's very relevant to the life issue. We see a connection between many of these large flood features, these large channels, and volcanoes. Some of the biggest ones are around this volcano, which is called Elysium Mons. And what probably happened is that you had dikes moving out from the volcano, basalt being moved through the ground, and it intersects this ice-rich ground, and you get these floods, and probably a lot of ash and steam and so forth. And yes, I think there's been a lot of interaction between the volcanoes and this water-rich surface, and it's probably going on until recent times.
Talking about the Mars this hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Here with David DeMurray, Michael Carr, and Tori Holler. Tori, you want to jump in there? Say something?
Yeah, I think it's important to follow this thread about the volcanoes. That was really a great question. What makes volcanoes exciting is not only the heat they transport, but the other stuff they transport. You can sort of think of a planet like a big battery. It has chemically different layers, and when those layers are brought into contact, just like connecting the terminals on a battery, you bring a lot of energy and leave a lot of potential for life to survive. And we see this demonstrated over and over again in places like hydrothermal vents and hot springs. And so what's very intriguing and interesting, I think, about volcanoes on Mars is they represent a place where maybe not only do you have liquid water a little bit closer to the surface because of the heat, but you also have a potential system that's delivering energy. And those represent a very intriguing and compelling place, I think, to think about life.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if I can get a phone call in here from Larry in Philadelphia. Hi, Larry.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi. Go ahead.
I was wondering, due to the different environment, the different energy sources on Mars, have you had to look into different ways of testing and processing the information, like sort of think outside the box, I guess, to gather information and process what you have?
Well, first I'd like to emphasize is that we think that some of the chemical reactions on Mars that we would be looking for as sources of energy for life are very much similar to what examples we could find on the Earth. And, for example, I'm thinking about iron. If you take iron that's sort of in its reduced state in rocks and you subject that to water or to oxidation, you get energy out of that, chemical energy. And we have microorganisms on the Earth that can do that kind of thing. And lo and behold, we see evidence now in places on Mars where there's been alteration by water that the iron has been oxidized. So in principle, we already see an example of a kind of chemistry, and that is iron oxidation, that we would look for on Mars, and then as we look for evidence of it, look for other evidence like of little tiny cells or organic matter or other features that would also characterize any life that might be there. Another example is sulfur. If we can see evidence of, like in fumaroles, as Tori mentioned, in volcanoes, the sulfur that comes out that gets oxidized could be another kind of chemical reaction that organisms can use. And so if we find places on Mars where we have reason to believe that sulfur might have been oxidized, the tools that we take to analyze for that reaction and then again look for other features would be something to consider. So I think the organisms that are good at living in these places that we think might also occur on Mars also tell us the types of measurements, chemical measurements, we might want to make.
Mm-hmm. What about these meteorites that come from Mars that land on Earth? They pick them up in Antarctica off the ice, and we once had that very controversial one that we possibly thought there were signs of.
Yeah, and what's interesting about that meteorite, if you put the life controversy to one side for a minute, is, well, the thing to me that's most profound about it is its incredible age. This is a rock that's almost 4.5 billion years in age and was altered in some way to make carbonates 4 billion years ago. And all the arguments that you heard, they were arguing about features that are tiny, less than a micron. I mean, you know, a tenth of a micron. I mean, these rocks have lasted all these billions of years and preserved all this fine textural information. And if nothing else, they tell us that there is a rich, ancient record of what happened on Mars, and we just have to go read it.
All right, we're going to take a short break, come back, and talk lots more with our guests, Dave DeMaray, Michael Carr, and Tori Holler, and take questions from our audience. Talking about Mars, maybe we'll talk about what the next Mars rover might look like. You know, bigger than a bread box, much bigger, I'm sure. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the search for life on Mars with my guests, David DeMaray of NASA's Ames Research Center. Also at NASA is Tori Holler, research scientist in astrobiology, and Michael Carr, planetary geologist at the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, California. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the, right to the podium. Yes, ma'am.
I have a question on behalf of my son, Patrick Lutz. He's a middle school student in Lexington, Kentucky. He's very interested in the question of, is there some other life out there in the universe? But he's bothered by the way we assume that life would be life as we recognize it and know it on this planet. For example, if you define it by its requirements, we require water and energy and some other things. But could there be life that doesn't require water? We know Stanley Miller, Harold Urey, 1953, their classic experiment, abiotic synthesis of organic molecules from non-organic molecules in water or using water. But could life arise without water? Are we looking for something and missing it, even though it's there, because we're defining it the way we define it? Now, the real question is, how do we define life so that we can exclude fire, which reproduces, uses oxygen, transforms chemical energy to heat energy, and so on, but doesn't require water, obviously?
Tori, do you want to answer that?
Yeah, I can give it a shot. I think, first of all, Patrick should come to work with us at NASA Ames Research Center. We could really use him.
I think
there.
His mom already does, it sounds like. Yeah. Go ahead.
You know, it's a great question, and it actually bothers me as well that we look for life based on definitions that very much match up with what we have here. I think an answer to the does life need water question is there are some very bright chemists out there who have come up with what I think are reasonably plausible schemes for other types of life. It's important to ask what it is that we need water for. We need water as a medium to allow the complex bits and pieces that we're made up of to interact. We need it as a thing that dissolves some of our biology and not other parts of our biology. There may be other things that can play that role. Interestingly, I think that none of the plausible alternatives are reasonable for Mars. So for Mars, it's actually not bad, I think, to really pin it all on water. When talking about life elsewhere in the universe, I think it really is necessary to think as broadly as possible and to avoid very narrow definitions of life. In fact, what I favor is to define life only to the extent that you gain some useful information with which to mount a search or to understand a little bit more about where it might be.
Could it exist without oxygen on Mars?
Certainly, we have organisms that exist without oxygen here. In fact, the first half of our planet's history was essentially an oxygen-free history, and so those are our roots. The appearance of oxygen on Earth was very nearly a catastrophe for life. In fact, because it's just so reactive and so hard to deal with.
If you were looking for life on Mars, and you were looking on some of the planets out the moons of Jupiter, Saturn, you know, a place like Europa, would you be looking for something different?
I think in the case of Europa, so much of the excitement about Europa has been for a similar reason as to Mars, and that is that it's a place where liquid water seems to exist as best we can tell. I think that in order to find something very different, you'd be interested maybe in a place like Titan, a place where the chemistry is not dominated by water, but dominated by something fundamentally different. Lakes of ethane and atmosphere.
We've seen those new pictures that have come back. Yeah, very interesting. All right, let's go to right here on the podium. So.
Hi, I'm a student from Foothill High School, and I was just wondering, do the erosions on Mars have to be from water? Could it be from a different liquid?
Somebody once said carbon dioxide in a paper I read a few months, years ago. You guys are, you should be looking at the CO2 could be liquid form on Mars also.
Well, in the early 1970s, when we really got to see what these, in quotation marks, water-worn features were like, a lot of other kinds of liquids were examined. For example, lava. Lava cuts channels. Could these be lava channels? Some suggested some suggested liquid carbon dioxide. But all these other fluids created many more problems than water. And in fact, we have really, apart from the morphology of the surface, we know there's water on Mars. We've measured it. And we know that some of these mineral molds that that the Mir rovers, for example, are finding in these sediments had to be dissolved by water. We know the sulfates there all over Mars, that's a water-soluble salt. So there's lots of other supportive evidence that water is in fact.
What about the poles? We see them growing, the ice and the...
Yeah, there's water ice at the poles, and we know at high latitudes there's water ice just below the ground. So,
Why not go to those places? Dave? He looks at Dave.
Well,
Dave, you're the long-term planner. Why not go to those places?
And these rovers are solar-powered.
Oh, I see.
One of the big challenges with planetary exploration is you got to bring the energy, the energy. And you pretty much have to stay within maybe 20 to 30 degrees of the equator on Mars, and you sure don't want to go beyond the orbit of Mars unless you have some other source of energy for you. So going to a polar environment for us is a challenge. Now, of course, the Phoenix mission is going to launch this August.
And tell us about that.
And it's just a fixed lander that will land at, some 60 degrees or so latitude. Anyway, up to a point to where, vapors and volatiles moving in and out of the surface will be something that it can be measured. It can measure, and it'll actually paw down a bit and try to analyze the material and even see if there's organics in there or something. But that mission is guaranteed not to last beyond the fall season. It's going to be a short-term mission, and that'll be pretty much it.
Why is that guaranteed not to last?
Well, because after that time, the temperatures, as the seasons change, will get so cold that not only will it run out of power, but the low temperatures will damage the spacecraft.
Well, your rovers were supposed to be a three-hour tour also.
A three-month tour, yeah.
Right, and they went for 3 years.
There were times when we thought it might only be 3 hours.
the 3 years now, right?
That's right.
Tremendous success.
And one of the serendipitous things that happened for us was that wind blew the dust off our solar panels, a little dust devil or whatever. I think for Phoenix, it's just a much more profound seasonal challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name's Elon. I'm a senior at Lowell High School here in San Francisco. And I was wondering what implications there are to possible future human civilizations on Mars due to the existence of water. Like, would it be possible to drill into the aquifers in the subsurface and harvest the water for our own use?
Yeah. Let's say you get there. Let's say we do get there. Can we live there?
Well, that's an interesting question. Actually, the notion of a human station on the moon is to go to the pole in the moon where they think there might be the greatest chance of having water as an accessible resource. There's an interesting little twist with Mars that I have to mention at that point, and that is there's an international agreement that we will not go and contaminate Mars with terrestrial organisms, because if there is Martian life there, then this would be a scientific tragedy, and there's a lot of ethical issues involved as well. So the idea for the first human station on Mars would be to pick a place that where the chances of intersecting the Mars biology would be minimized, and that's probably somewhere near the equator, probably in an area which from an astrobiological point of view wouldn't be terribly interesting, but you could operate there a series of robots perhaps to other parts of the planet. So the question is, what's the water resource that we can get at that place? Drilling into the subsurface is getting to be a little no-no here too, right? Because if you get down to where that aquifer is, you're running up against the same problem. That's actually, the answer to your question is the topic of a very important line of investigation within NASA right now, and that is in situ resource utilization. How can we utilize resources there that are both enough to give the astronauts what they would need, but also satisfy these concerns about, you know, keeping away from Mars biology if it's there.
There was also talk, Tori, of actually sending reactors to the surface that could create take hydrogen out of the soil in advance, even before people got there, so you could create fuel to go home. Have you familiar with it? Am I making this up?
I don't think you're making it up. I think, you know, sort of a simple answer to that question is to do anything substantial with people on Mars, we almost have to look to the natural resources. And I think that all of these things are going to have to be thought through. The energy is a very big one because it's every little bit of mass that you take with you costs you an awful lot in terms of how much it takes to get there. And so looking not only for water resources, but also for the sorts of energy resources that would get you home, is an important thing. And really what we're talking about there is the sun is still a pretty decent energy source at Mars. It's not as bright as here, but it's still not bad. And what we're looking for are ways to take that solar energy and transform it into a form that actually becomes fuel for us to do what we want to do.
Mm. Dave, you knew what I was talking about, right?
In-situ resource utilization. ISR. Yeah. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, it's called an ISRU. Yeah, NASA has all these
acronyms, because they're connected to Washington. Yeah. That's why.
In-situ resource units, a pilot program, to test out the possibility of getting hydrogen.
Yeah. All right, sir, at the microphone.
Hi, my name is Jake. I'm a senior at Lowell High School here in San Francisco. And my question is, how long ago was the climate shift that cooled Mars and moved the water from the surface to below the surface? And what caused that shift?
Michael, you want
to? Yeah. Well, the timing of this change from where we see lots and lots of evidence of dry river valleys and the implication being that there was a warm climate and precipitation and so on, the timing of that to the later, colder period is really quite well established. Because it coincided almost with what we call a heavy bombardment, the period when early Mars was being hit by large meteorites at a very high rate, and that dropped off rapidly. And about the same time, the rate of formation of these dry river valleys dropped off. And that was about 3.7 billion years ago.
All right. Thanks for the question. Yes, ma'am. You're next.
Hi, my name is Chelsea, and I attend Lowell High School. I'm a senior, and my question is, has there been any evidence suggesting the occurrence of other natural disasters and volcanoes? And if so, how could that affect the possibility of life on Mars?
Volcanoes, Dave?
I mean, large events on Mars that might have affected its... Again, we have, as Mike mentioned, evidence of explosive volcanism where it seems that volcanic activity has intersected water bodies in the subsurface. We have, of course, Olympus Mons, which is, and the Tharsis region, which have summit calderas that the tops of the volcanoes that may have been active within the last few hundred millions of years. I don't know if anyone has addressed what the climatologic implications of a large eruption from those would be, but they have happened, and certainly on timescales of 100 million years or so. And I guess you could look to Earth to see what the consequences of a large eruption would have been, and say that it would be a big challenge, I think, for the kinds of life that we think about, plants and animals and so forth. I think the microbes could probably ride these through, and in fact, in many cases, the volcanic activity, as Tori mentioned, is a source of energy for them. So they happened. They would be a big problem for an astronauts or plants on Mars. The microbes could probably ride them through and in some cases benefit from.
We're talking about Mars this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let's take the last question from the audience here.
My name's Chris. I am not a senior at Lowell High School. I have an overview question, not from a Luddite point of view, but I'd just be curious from the three of you, why do this work? When you look into the future, what are there practical aspects that are going to come back to us? If so, when? What might that look like? What's in it for you to do what you do?
Do you agree with Stephen Hawking when he said, if we're going to survive, we have to leave this planet?
I hope I don't have to agree with him.
We're using it up and we have to go someplace else. Yeah. So what, as the lady said, what motivates you?
Well, I think what motivates me is a chance to understand how life might have begun and how different it could be. In the end, at the moment, we just have one example of life, and some of the questions indicated that if there's any possibility of life elsewhere, it could be different in important ways. I think to understand really what life is, you need more than one example. Because in the end, the example that we have here on the Earth really reflects the outcome of what happened on the Earth, the particular history of this planet. In that sense, planets are like organisms, or they're like life itself. Each one not only is the physics and the chemistry, but it's also a history. Life has remembered its history, and that's much of what it is when you see it. Same thing with planets. And if you believe that with planets, then the kind of life we have on the Earth is inseparably related to the Earth's history. Another planet, another kind of life.
Michael, you agree? Different for you?
Because
it's there?
Because it's there. It's a natural curiosity. It's like, does knowledge of the formation of the universe have a practical consequence? I don't think, probably not. But it's inherent in us to want to know how everything came about. Mm-hmm. And life, of course, is particularly personal need.
Sorry?
I think maybe another way to view that question is that you often, in this line of work, get the question, well, what do you honestly think? Is life out there? Do you think that life is on Mars? And the answer that I usually give is, I honestly don't know, but I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't think that it was at least possible. To address that question scientifically, there are so many unknowns in this question. I sort of divide Mars history up into two parts. There's the part when things were good at the surface and water was around and sunlight was present. And there's a question as to whether or not life could take hold at that point. Mm-hmm. There's a question about the subsequent history of Mars. Could life survive that subsequent 3.5 billion years in the subsurface? I almost think it's easier to address that second part of the question and more plausible to get to the answer. The first part really gets to issues of, is life a rarity or is it a commonality in the universe? If the right set of conditions come together for a long enough time, is life something that will always originate? And there are very smart people who debate opposite sides of that question. I think in trying to find some empirical evidence for life out there, we're actually looking for a way to address that question.
I have about 30 seconds left. Do we have to go personally there, or do we have robots that are smart enough, David, that we could say?
I think ultimately, I mean, the robots would be incredibly capable. Already it's 50 times cheaper to get a sample back from the moon than humans could do it compared to the way it was in 1960. So I think the future is for robotic exploration is really very bright. But I think there's an engagement, there's an involvement that humans going to a place brings to the thing. And given that it's such an important issue psychologically and in many ways, I think that's an important aspect.
All right, and that's where we're going to have to leave it. I want to thank all of you gentlemen for taking time to be with us this hour. David DeMarais, a long-term planning lead for the Mars Exploration Rover mission. As we get closer to that, we'll talk more about that, what's coming up on the next rover. As a senior research scientist in the astrobiology program at NASA Ames Research Center. Also at NASA Ames is Tori Holler, a research scientist in the astrobiology department. And Michael Carr, planetary geologist at the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, California. Because when you talk about planets, you're talking about their geology now. The astronomers are not looking at planets anymore. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today. Our program is produced by Karen Vergoth and senior producer Annette Heist. Our directors are Gwen Newton in Washington, Charles Berquist in San Francisco. Flora Lichtman is our producer for digital media. Dahlia Martinez and Susan Lund work the phones for us today in Washington. If you missed any part of the program, surf over to our site, sciencefriday.com. We've got podcasts there. Back editions, this program will be up there for you to download. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection, free teaching materials. That we make at a Science Friday, so you can just click on the teachers button over there. Also, we have blogs and folks in out there in social communities talking about Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow in San Francisco.